So what is wrong with American politics today? And how would you change the political system if you could? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are going to welcome in Mike McCabe. He is the author of Blue Jeans in High Places, The Coming Makeover of American Politics. And we'll talk about that makeover. We'll talk about his proposed solutions for reinvigorating our politics, our political system, and how he thinks a new movement representing the bottom and middle classes could successfully arise. And we'll welcome your questions and your views at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Mike McCabe is the executive director of Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, and his book is Blue Jeans in High Places. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
So what do you mean by blue jeans in high places?
Well, I was actually speaking to the state convention of the Wisconsin Farmers Union some time ago, and I don't really know what possessed me to do this, but I had 250 farmers in front of me, and I asked them a question. I said, how many of you happen to own a donkey? And not a single hand went up, and I was surprised. I said, oh, come on, out of 250 farmers, somebody's still got to have a donkey on their land, and not a hand goes up. I said, how many of you own an elephant? And again, no hands go up. And I said, how many of you own a pair of blue jeans? And every single hand in the audience went up. And I said, okay, what would be a more fitting symbol for us as a people, a donkey, an elephant, or a pair of blue jeans? And what would better distinguish us as a people from the suits on Wall Street and K Street and Capitol Hill who are lording over us, a donkey, an elephant, or a pair of blue jeans? And the reaction I got from the audience inspired the title of the book. And it seems to me that here we are stuck with political symbols that date back to the 19th century, where our politics in a lot of ways is stuck in a time warp. And you know, I think the moment has come. It's one of those historic moments where it's time for a very extensive renovation of the political landscape. And in the past, our great-grandparents, our great-great-grandparents also imagine new political identities and ways of breaking out of traps that they were ensnared in. I think we've got to do the same. We've got to think about reimagining politics in a way that creates a system that puts citizens back in the driver's seat of our government at a time when both political parties are really failing us.
Yeah. Well, what do you mean? Aren't we voting our, you know, elected representatives into office? Aren't we in the driver's seat by going to the voting booth?
Well, look at the horrible voter turnout in the August primary. 10% of the people show up. Even in a presidential election, we're lucky if we get upwards of 60%. Barely half of the people will show up to vote. And really, an awful lot of people who are voting feel as though they have no choice but to kind of hold their nose and choose between what they regard as the lesser of two evils. There's tremendous disillusionment with both major parties at this moment. In fact, the percentage of Americans who refuse to identify with either major party is at its highest level in three quarters of a century. That's Gallup polling that says that. And you know, and so every once in a while, people will have their dalliances with a third party or independent candidate. You know, it might be Ross Perot one time, Ralph Nader another. That ends up leading people to a dead end. It doesn't get them political satisfaction. And so really, people have been conditioned to believe we only got three options. And the third option is withdrawal. It's resignation. And that's what an awful lot of people are doing. They're throwing up their hands and they're saying, you know what, if my vote isn't really going to do us much good, if my voice isn't being heard, I'm going to pull out. And I think right now we're in an era where the politics of resignation is endemic to American society. We got to do something about that. That's not an acceptable condition. And you know, the book tries to offer some suggestions about how we might think our way out of this.
Well, you mentioned some of the failed third party endeavors. So if it's not third party, what is it?
What I describe in the book is what I call a first party movement. We've got a two party system, and that's something that we have to come to terms with as a people. We're not a parliamentary democracy. We don't have competing factions forming coalition governments. We don't have proportional representation that would allow third parties to actually have representation in a Congress or in our legislature. We have a two-party system, and that system very rigidly enforces a two-party arrangement. So when change has come to the political parties, it hasn't been by the emergence of a third party. It has been something that has transformed one or both of the major parties. And that's where I think we've got to focus our energy. A third-party movement organizes to the left of the Democrats or to the right of the Republicans. A first-party movement goes for the heart. It seeks to compete for the affections of the entire electorate, not the fringes of the electorate, either to the left of the Democrats or the right of the Republicans, but actually competes for the affections of all voters. And the other fundamental difference between a third-party movement and a first-party movement is the goal of a third-party movement is to have three or more political parties. The goal of a first-party movement is to have one that truly owes its allegiance to the people. And I think our biggest single problem right now in American politics is that so many people feel politically homeless. So many people believe that neither party is reflecting their wishes or serving their interests or even listening to their voices because they're so busy catering to wealthy donors and those special interests that hold dominion over our system.
So would this first party be a moderate party that is in the middle of the Republicans and the Democrats?
No, I think that's actually one of the fallacies that people fall into is that they assume that people would naturally gravitate to the center. Actually, the electorate, is not necessarily wanting government to be bland or to be centrist. What they want is loyalty, fidelity to the people, and they believe that that's missing in both major parties. So, you know, the interesting thing, Joy, and there's a whole chapter in the book devoted to this, we've been conditioned to think and talk horizontally about politics. Who's on the left, who's on the right, who's in the middle, who's liberal, who's conservative, who's moderate. I talk about the magical thing that happens if you flip that spectrum up on its head and think vertically and think who's on top and who's on the bottom, not just economically, but also who's got the strongest voice, who's got the weakest, who's got the most political power, who has the least. And when you do that, a magical thing happens. You take a woman, let's say a nurse in Milwaukee. Chances are she's African American. Chances are she's low income, not earning a lot of money. She's also most likely a liberal or a Democrat on the political spectrum, if you think horizontally. Now take a man, say, living in Clark County, where I grew up, farm country. He's white. He's also poor. Clark County is one of the five poorest counties in Wisconsin. He's conservative. He's a Republican. Scott Walker won Clark County by over 30 percentage points in 2012. You put them on a vertical spectrum, they're almost exactly in the same spot, both in terms of their voice, in terms of their political clout, in terms of their economics. They're exactly in the same spot in the spectrum. They couldn't be farther apart if you think horizontally. So we're needlessly dividing people who could be united and who have a great deal in common politically, but wedges have been driven in between them and have separated them, and they see each other as enemies. Well, you know, that's by design. You know, the ruling class in our country has a great interest in keeping the masses of voters as divided as possible because it keeps them in the driver's seat. There are ways to think our way out of that and help put citizens in the driver's seat instead. The numbers of the masses of Americans who have a lot in common are great. If they are divided, they are politically weak. You find ways to unite them, they suddenly become a much more potent force in American politics.
Talk a little bit more, though, about the similarities in politics between, you know, an African-American single mother in Milwaukee and that Clark County farmer in terms of maybe they're economically they might be similar, but aren't they going to have a whole lot different opinions as to what needs to be done in social policies and other things?
Well, any two citizens will have differences. The thing is that all of us are, none of us is a purebred politically. I don't think there, normal people aren't exclusively liberal or exclusively conservative. We're all ideological mutts. We're liberal about some things, conservative about some things. Any two people are going to have differences on certain policies, but those two people have an incredible amount in common. First of all, on economics, they're both in very vulnerable positions. They are living on the edge economically. The system is not working for them. But more importantly, you know, they are victims of income and wealth inequality because of political inequality. Political inequality produces wealth inequality, and they are on the bottom rung of the ladder when it comes to political influence. Neither party is really listening to them. Neither party is really working for their interests or putting them first, because politicians in both parties are so busy catering to their donors and putting policies in place that reward those donors that those two people are both left out of the equation when it comes to solving their problems or addressing their issues. So they've got an incredible amount in common. And they have something mutually at stake here, whether they have a voice in the political process. If they unite and put aside some of the extraneous differences, but they see that they see their common interest in getting citizens a stronger voice in the political arena, if they unite, they both can benefit greatly. And right now, you know, they both feel politically homeless. They may hold their nose and one vote for a Democrat and the other vote for a Republican, but neither of them, if you really talk to them, are feeling as though those parties are really working for them. That's the problem in American politics today, is the growing ranks of the politically homeless.
So how do they unite?
I think one of the keys is to see how they've been manipulated to be divided and conquered by the way we think and talk about politics. And I think one incredibly important step is for us to stop thinking and talking horizontally, start thinking and talking vertically, because when you do that, those two people suddenly realize they are at the exact same spot. They are on the same rung of the political and economic ladder, and that they've got an awful lot to gain by seeing their common interests. So I think it starts with the way we talk and think about politics. But then I think the other thing is that we've been conditioned to believe that there are only three options. Either it's the two major parties, and a lot of people think that that means holding your nose and choosing between the lesser of evils. It's a third party candidate, that's a dead end, or it's withdrawal or resignation. What fascinates me is that our great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents realized that there was actually a fourth door. And when they opened that door, what they found behind it was transformational. It was landscape-altering. They changed the face of American politics by opening that fourth door. We've been conditioned not even to accept that it exists. We don't even acknowledge the existence of that door, much less open it. Behind that fourth door is a first-party movement. Stop thinking about simply accepting the two parties as they are. Stop thinking that maybe a third party or independent candidate will be the way out of the trap. And do as our great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents did and realize there actually is a fourth door. And it's what I describe as that first-party movement, where you actually go in and seek to transform one or both of the major parties. And when it's happened before in history, it's often had its roots right here in Wisconsin. And when there have been successful transformations or renovations of the political landscape, in one case that I write about in the book, it was one party that was driven to extinction and replaced by a whole new identity. In the other case, both major parties were transformed. Both major parties adapted to the new threat, and the landscape was changed in both parties. So it can happen both ways. You could have one party changed. You could have both parties significantly transformed. You could have one party cease to exist in its current form and actually be removed from the scene and replaced by a new political movement. It's happened in all those different ways over the course of American history. The fascinating thing is that those movements have often had their roots right here in Wisconsin.
We'll talk more about this first party movement that Mike McCabe is describing, and we'll welcome your questions on how would you transform American politics? What do you think of this coming makeover that Mike McCabe is prescribing or predicting? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Are you disillusioned with American politics and the two parties as they are? Would you welcome a new movement, this first party movement? What else do you think needs to be done to cure our political system's problems? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Mike McCabe, author of Blue Jeans in High Places, The Coming Makeover of American Politics. Mike McCabe is talking about his proposed solutions for reinvigorating our politics and how he thinks a new movement, a first way movement, is the answer. And we're welcoming your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Mike, just before break, you were talking about how we might be able to transform one or both of the political parties so that they perhaps are representing we the people. Isn't that going on right now in the Republican Party? Isn't there isn't the Tea Party movement this grassroots movement of conservatives who are indeed transforming the Republican Party?
Well, the Tea Party movement is part of what I was reflecting on, and one of the many inspirations for writing this book, because it occurred to me that, you know, David Koch, one of the billionaire Koch brothers, was once on a presidential ticket. He was the vice presidential nominee of the Libertarian Party in 1980. He ran as a third-party candidate, and they lost miserably. Didn't matter how much money they had, that was a route that got them nowhere. And then the Koch brothers spent 10 years planning the launching of the Tea Party. And what struck me is that, you know, they didn't create a party at all. They created a new identity that they would use to try to take over a party. Now, they did it for very self-serving reasons. This was not a grassroots movement. This was pure astroturf. This was something that was designed by the Koch brothers for 10 years. And they did it to create an environment where they could get policies much more favorable to them. And it occurred to me, why couldn't citizens use the exact same kind of strategy for a much more public-spirited purpose? And then I look back at history and realized that ordinary citizens, common folk, had actually done it, and it had worked. The original Republicans went into a little white schoolhouse in Ripon, Wisconsin. They went into that schoolhouse calling themselves Democrats or Whigs. The Whig Party was one of the two major parties. Some of them called themselves Free Soilers. Both major parties at the time were ostensibly pro-slavery parties. There was a growing abolitionist movement that felt politically homeless. They went into that schoolhouse calling themselves Democrats and Whigs and Free Soilers. They came out united in calling themselves Republicans. They imagined a new political identity with an abolitionist agenda, and that transformed the political landscape and drove the Whig Party to extinction. Well, there was a great example of a first-party movement. The country didn't have three or more parties after that happened. It had two, because we have a two-party system. But the whole political arrangement, the landscape, had been dramatically altered. A generation later, Bob La Follette felt that his party, he was a Republican, he felt his party had grown corrupt, and he did the most fascinating thing. He renounced his political identity, said, I'm no longer calling myself a Republican, I'm calling myself a progressive. And the progressive movement actually transformed both parties. You had Teddy Roosevelt running as a progressive on the Republican Party ticket for president. Some years later, Woodrow Wilson ran as a progressive on the Democratic Party ticket. Both major parties embraced the identity. Both major parties embraced the accompanying agenda. And again, citizens had invented a new political identity and used that identity to force both major parties to either adapt or perish. And in that case, both parties adapted. Why couldn't we take that same strategy, one that the Koch brothers have very recently used? It's been used by people over the course of our history and even during our lifetimes. But do it to remedy this problem of the politically homeless. Build some housing for the politically homeless. Create an identity that people are actually drawn to. Because, face it, both major parties right now are repellent. They are repelling people. We need to create something that serves as a magnet and draws people in. Build a household that people actually want to live in.
Yeah. Clarify whether you do or do not advocate a Tea Party-like movement in the Democratic Party that, as the Tea Party pulled the Republicans to the right, maybe we need some sort of movement to pull Democrats to the left.
I think both major parties are both ripe for a first-party movement and are in need of that extensive renovation. I think both major parties are failing America. They're failing America in different ways. I'm not one of those people who says you can't tell the difference between the two parties. There are very obvious and noticeable differences between the parties, but they're both failing us. You know, and one of the things I often say to audiences when I talk about this is that we've got one party that's scary and another that's scared. And, you know, I've never yet been asked by a single person in a single audience to say which party is which. People instantly identify with that. It instantly resonates with people. We have one party that's scary and another that's scared. Both parties are failing America in different ways, but they're failing us nevertheless. So both parties are in need of renovation, and I think this is about getting plain people, common people, back in the driver's seat. The Tea Party movement did not do that. It was designed to serve the interests of the Koch brothers, and it was designed to create a party that had greater allegiance to that agenda. That leaves an awful lot of Main Street Republicans feeling politically homeless. You go out and talk to a lot of people who are inclined to consider themselves Democrats. They don't feel like the Democrats are really working for them. You talk to people, sort of old-fashioned Main Street Republicans, they feel their party's been stolen from them, and they feel politically homeless. You've got a situation, as I said, where the percentage of Americans who refuse to identify with either major party is at its highest level in 75 years. To me, those conditions haven't been seen in our country since the Gilded Age, since the age of the robber barons. Interestingly, that age of the robber barons is what produced one of the biggest first party movements our country's ever seen.
I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Mike McCabe. He is author of Blue Jeans in High Places, The Coming Makeover of American Politics. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Joe in Southwest Chicago first. Hello, Joe.
Hi. Hi, Mike. I want to say thank you for articulating what I've been trying to convey to my friends, both conservatives and liberals, that the focus is more on campaign finance and collecting money rather than fixing problems. And the point I try to make to my friends is that with campaign finance reform, that would eliminate most of these issues. I'm trying to comprehend your first party concept. I've only been listening for about 10 minutes or so, but with campaign finance reform, they would eliminate most of these issues. And if we could get both of these people in these parties to understand that it eliminates their voice in these issues. It just when they're just playing towards
Joe, let me jump in because I just want Mike McCabe to respond to whether or not campaign finance reform is the answer we're looking for here.
Well, you know, as I said, the two parties are not the same, but they're both failing us. One thing that they have in common is that they are joined at the billfold. Both parties are deeply invested in a system that leads elected officials to ceaselessly cater to a very small segment of society that provides all this money. All the money raised in by politicians is coming from barely 2% of the population. That leaves 98% of the population effectively unrepresented because they don't bring a check. They don't participate in the money game. So one of the reasons why so many people feel politically homeless is that the parties are catering to a tiny segment of society and not really serving the entire population. And you know, when the original Republicans felt politically homeless, we had two parties that were ostensibly pro-slavery parties. And there was this growing abolitionist movement that felt that it was without representation. They went into that schoolhouse, and what did they do? They invented a new political identity, and they stopped calling themselves Democrats or Whigs, and they started calling themselves Republicans. Well, what we've got now is two parties that are joined at the billfold. That's one of the things that the two major parties do have in common, is that they are addicted to this system that leads them to not truly be representative of the whole of the people. When you talk to Americans, Republican, Democrat, Independent, what they say is that my voice isn't being heard. My vote doesn't matter. My interests aren't being represented. My problems aren't being solved. And they understand that that's because politicians are too busy making their big donors happy. Well, that's the current reason for these widespread feelings of political homelessness. I think the response could be a modern version, adapting to modern circumstances, these strategies that have been used successfully. And when they've been used, it's worked. It has compelled the parties to reconnect meaningfully with the people. Again, at the time of the founding of the original Republican Party, what it forced was the parties to connect with this abolitionist movement that was out there. And of course, eventually slavery was abolished in this country. Well, the scourge of money in politics can be addressed, but it's going to take a party to do it. You can't get campaign finance reform when you've got two parties in power, either one of which, when they've been in power, have resisted fundamentally changing the system of money in politics.
Well, let me challenge you a little bit in that. Donors represent, unions, environmentalists, social justice people, and donors represent corporate interests. I mean, how can you say that the parties aren't the parties when they're passing legislation or seeking public policy changes based on their donors? That affects all of us, doesn't it? I mean, in terms of...
It affects...
Well, it's not necessarily that my beliefs are not being represented just because the Democratic or the Republican Party is voting on a piece of legislation that a donor favors or doesn't favor.
Clearly, the decisions that are made do affect all of us, but they don't benefit all of us. And, again, if you look at where the money comes from, all this political money is being raised from barely 2% of the population. It is undeniable that the wishes and interests of that donor class are often quite different and sometimes even diametrically opposed to the wishes and interests of the rest of the population. And when push comes to shove, those interests get served. They end up winning out. Take taxation, for example. We've effectively got two tax systems. One for the folks who can afford $200 an hour lobbyists and make big campaign donations, and they get all these tax breaks and loopholes and exemptions and exclusions written into the tax code that they get to exploit. And another tax system for the rest of us, we all end up paying more so that a few can pay less. That's a great example of the conflicted interests, the divided loyalties of politicians. And when push comes to shove, they feel that they don't have much choice but to represent the interests of those donors. So they end up making decisions that keep the donors happy, and often that comes at the expense of the rest of the population, or sometimes it even reflects policies or views that are diametrically opposed to what the people want. And you see that all the time. Polls show that the majority of citizens want one thing, and our elected officials do the exact opposite and pass a policy that doesn't reflect that majority opinion. There's a reason for that.
Yeah. All right, well, let's take another call. Ralph in Little Suamico is with us. Hello, Ralph.
Yes, hello. I got most of the conversation, probably missed the first 5 minutes, but and you kind of touched a little bit when you started talking about the Tea Party, but I can recall the convention in Minneapolis when they wouldn't let Ron Paul in to speak at all, and there was a big demonstration, which was the Tea Party at that time. And their biggest complaint at that time was the collapse of our economy because of manipulations by Wall Street and the corporate bankers. And this is basically the same thing that was the March on Wall Street. Now, the March on Wall Street was considered far left. The Tea Party is considered far right. And my point is, I think that they have a lot in common. And hopefully I thought at that time that they would get together and start a third party. But instead, all these little social issues came up. You know, like, I'm for abortion, I'm against abortion. I'm for gay marriage, I'm against gay marriage. And I think that it was a deliberate thing on the two established parties to create divisions between those two groups, because they had enough in common. And basically the thing they had was freedom for people to live their own lives and not be influenced by big corporations. I know the Koch brothers contributed, but somebody has to have the money or it won't go anyplace.
Mike?
There is a really striking set of similarities between those who are drawn to the Occupy movement and those who are drawn to the Tea Party movement. And I think the biggest common denominator is the fear of the downsizing of the American dream. You've got all these people sitting around kitchen tables and dining room tables worrying about the fact that they're concerned that their kids and grandkids are going to be the first generations of Americans who are less well off than their parents. And that is a fear that so many people in this country feel. And it is the common denominator behind the occupiers and the Tea Partiers. And boy, the caller hits the nail right on the head when he says that the major party establishments then get to work in trying to come up with all these other kinds of wedges that they can drive in between people who do have a great deal in common to divide and conquer them. And the only thing I would say in response to the caller that doesn't fully endorse what he had to say is I think the impulse should not be to create a third party, but to actually try to create a first party. Don't make the mistake that some have made and try to operate outside a two-party system, but actually go in and try to create a party that actually owes its allegiance to the people. And that's what I describe as a first-party movement.
And if we succeed in a first-party movement, does that mean the Democratic Party or the Republican Party goes away and it becomes this other party?
It depends on how those party establishments respond. Again, the Whig Party was stubborn and refused to adapt to the Republican, the threat of this new Republican identity and the abolitionist agenda, and the Whigs were driven to extinction. A generation later, both major parties realized that this progressive identity and the accompanying agenda was where the people really were. That's where the masses were, and they both adapted to it. They both embraced the agenda, and you had the Republican and Democratic standard bearers running for president as progressives and ushering in all these progressive policies. So it can happen either way. It could mean that one party will cease to exist in its current form. It could mean that both parties will be transformed. It could mean one party, you know, in Wisconsin, there was a time when Joe McCarthy was our U.S. senator, and this was a pure red Republican state, and a group of reformers called themselves the Young Turks and went in and took over the Democratic Party and made Wisconsin a two-party state again, and got the Democratic Party back on its feet and made the Democratic Party a viable force in Wisconsin. That was a first-party movement. That the Young Turks went in and changed a political party and turned Wisconsin from a one-party Republican state to a two-party state that could go either way. Sometimes we've had Democrats win office here. Sometimes we've had Republicans. That was because of a first-party movement in our lifetimes.
We are talking with Mike McCabe, author of the book Blue Jeans in High Places, The Coming Makeover of American Politics. What do you think of his proposed solution here for reinvigorating our politics? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So what is the biggest threat to democracy in the United States? Our guest says the answer is our growing sense of powerlessness. And he is talking about his proposed solutions for our political system on how a new movement, a first-party movement, is what we need. We're talking about that first-party movement, and we're welcoming your thoughts and questions. Mike McCabe is the author of Blue Jeans in High Places, The Coming Makeover of American Politics. Let's go to Ian in Wapaka next. Hello, Ian.
Hi. I just want to make a comment. I think this gentleman's nailed it 100%. You know, neither party serves the people at all anymore, and I think they should just both be called the donor parties. And, you know, I'm definitely going to go and buy his book, and I'll just take my comments off the air.
They should both call themselves the donor parties.
Well, you know, the two parties have got their differences, but like I said, they're joined at the billfold, and they have resisted change of this money game. That has led people to become more and more estranged from either party. That leaves us in a condition where people feel politically homeless. That's not a sustainable condition. We've got to change that.
John emails, if so many people do not identify with either party, why are we seeing increasingly polarized voting? Aren't people gravitating even more to the two parties?
No, they're gravitating. Most people are withdrawing, and the electorate is getting shrunk. It's getting whittled down, and what you've got left are only those party loyalists. You know, look, there are some people who are faithful to the Republican Party, and there are some people who are very satisfied and faithful to the Democratic Party. But the biggest single block of voters, the biggest single block of citizens, I should say, are people who are deeply disillusioned with both parties. A lot of those people have simply withdrawn. They don't vote at all. And what we are then left with are the more fierce partisans left in the electorate. That does create much more polarization. Well, if we had a successful first-party movement and we saw the creation of something that would draw those disillusioned people back into the political process, that would have the effect of beginning to unite people who are now hopelessly divided. But what we're left with is really just the biggest loyalists, the most fierce partisans who do participate in the process. That does leave us with a very polarized environment, and it's not healthy.
I'm just curious. So, couldn't the argument be made that those who feel especially homeless are those who perhaps have extremely liberal views, the far left, that they complain that the Democratic Party is too much in the middle, too much in the center, being pulled to the right, and the Republican Party is being pulled to the right. So it's the far left that everything's being pulled to the right.
Well, I have used that line on many audiences, that we've got one party that's scary and another that's scared, and people instantly relate to that and connect with it. You talk to Republicans, and I think what they feel is the Main Street Republicans feel like their party has become extreme and it's been stolen from them, and it's not working for the people. It's serving the interests of a very narrow group of interests. Democrats feel that their party is scared, and that they feel like it's not willing to stand up and actually be bold and imaginative and offer solutions for problems that our country needs solved. So, you know, different people feel politically homeless for different reasons, but I think it is a bipartisan phenomenon. You see people in both parties who feel like, wait a second, the party that I thought was mine doesn't belong to me anymore. That's a condition that has existed before in American history. What fascinates me is that people with an awful lot less money, less education, fewer means of communication, rose up against those conditions and actually beat them, and they dug themselves out of the holes that they were buried in, and we can do the same thing. This kind of thing has worked in the past; it can work again.
Daniel in Minong is with us. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. Will the demographic shift, the Browning of America, effectively alter both parties and shift both parties towards the center of the political spectrum?
More Latinos, more African Americans voting, perhaps. Will that bring both parties to the center?
Oh, not necessarily, and you know, you could make a strong case that it will eventually draw, you know, if you want to get stuck in that horizontal thinking and you want to think left and right, you can make the case that it will draw the country slowly to the left. I actually think, there's a whole chapter in the book about the impact that the millennial generation will eventually have on American politics. The millennials, the teens and 20-somethings, think very differently than the rest of the population on a whole host of issues, social issues, but also some economic issues. And I think the millennials right now are sort of biding their time. They do feel very powerless. I hear older people criticize young people for being apathetic. When I go to college campuses and high school classrooms, I do not find apathy. What I do find is powerlessness. They're passionate about what's going on in America. They know a lot more than we think they know about what's going on in public affairs, but they don't think there's a darn thing they can do about it. That's something that we have to address. I don't think the problem is apathy, not even with voting. The problem's not apathy. The problem's powerlessness, and there's a difference between those two things. Apathy is when you don't care. With powerlessness, you can care a great deal, but you don't think that your efforts will make a difference. We've got to create something that gives people hope that their energy and that their efforts can be transformative.
Yeah. Well, so maybe let's talk a little bit more about that. We talked some about how you would get this first party movement going, and one was just the change of attitude and not, you know, thinking vertically rather than horizontally. So what else? I mean, once we do that, I mean, and how do we do that anyway?
You know, and I think, as silly as it sounds, I think it starts with imagining a new political identity. And that's why I called the book Blue Jeans in High Places, because of that reaction that I got from the farmers at the State Farmers Union convention. I said, well, how many of you own a donkey? Almost nobody. How many of you own an elephant? Nobody. How many of you own a pair of blue jeans? Everybody can relate to that. That's something that unites us as a people. It's something that we all have in common. And, you know, when you've seen revolutions abroad, in the Ukraine, you had the bulldozer rebellion and in Yugoslavia, the Orange Revolution. So why does it have to be an animal anyway that is the symbol of us as a people? When first party movements have succeeded in the past, they started thinking a little differently. They coalesced around a new agenda, a new set of ideas. But one of the things that they did is they also broke free of the established order and they established a new political identity. And I think that's something that we have to do in our time. We have to create a new political identity. People don't feel like they can proudly call themselves, most people don't feel they can proudly call themselves Democrats or Republicans, but we need to create a symbol or an identity that people can proudly rally around, and then that identity can be used to transform one or both of the parties. And that's exactly what's happened before. In every case we've seen a first party movement, the original Republicans, the progressives, the Young Turks, more recently, in every case, they created an identity and used that identity to help transform the political system.
So who's going to do this? Are you going to do this? How can you do this if you're leaving the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign at the end of the year?
Well, you know, the Democracy Campaign does extraordinarily important work tracking the money in politics. I've done this for 15 years now. I really looked at this and said, well, I could do this for another 15 years. I could track the money, but would it get us to a better place? And we've advocated for campaign finance reform. One of the earlier callers said how important that is. We've advocated for campaign finance reform. But if you advocate for that agenda and you take it up the steps of the Capitol and there's nobody inside who's willing to take it in and really fight for it in the Capitol, you're still blocked. So my energies are going to be devoted to doing my part to try to create a first-party movement that can help create a party that is devoted to the kind of change that will reconnect the political process to ordinary people. And I'll try to get as many people to join me in that endeavor. And you know, if we fail, we fail. But the one thing that we have to do is we have to open that fourth door. We can't be stuck with these three options, either the two parties as they are today, a third party movement, which will frustrate us, or political withdrawal. We've got to accept that there's this fourth door we can open, and we need to open it.
Leah in Green Bay is with us. Hi, Leah.
Hi. Well, I do love an idealist, and some people have called me that, but I think the first party idea is very dangerous, because if you allow one party a lot of power, you know what can happen. We've seen it in Russia in 1917. We've seen it in Nazi Germany. We've seen it in Spain. So I think it's way too simplistic to say everyone's going to be joined at the hip because we all have common problems. It's true that a lot of us do, but that is not the way to solve it. And yes, it's hard to get money out of politics, but I really believe that is the way that we have to change the laws, get rid of corporations as people, and start taking money out. You know, in Europe, they don't charge people for going on television during the political season, which is very short.
I get, Leah, and because we only have less than a couple of minutes to go here, Mike, one party is dangerous, she's saying.
We should never have a one-party movement. A first-party movement is not an only-party movement. First-party movements seek to create, within our two-party system, two parties that actually owe their allegiance to the people. And if you have one that truly embraces that, the other will have to adapt to that. So we're not talking about a one-party movement or an only-party movement. We're talking about trying to get two parties that have grown disconnected from the large masses of our population to reconnect with those masses and stop simply catering to wealthy elites and big donors. I guess when people say, well, you know, maybe it can't work, my reaction to that is, well, it's worked repeatedly over the course of American history.
So we have less than a minute to go. When will we see the Blue Jean Party on the ticket?
Well, I don't, you know, it won't be on a separate ticket. I think we could have a situation where you'd eventually have blue jean Democrats running in Democratic races, blue jean Republicans challenging the Republican establishment in Republican Party races. You don't run as a third party. You don't go off on a separate ticket. You go for the heart of the electorate within the two-party system.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Joy.
Mike McCabe, author of Blue Jeans in High Places, The Coming Makeover of American Politics. He is also the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign through the end of this year. Thanks to Christy Taylor and to Justin Williams and to Marika Saval for producing and directing this program. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned. There's much more to come. I hope you are with us tomorrow at this time. It'll be another edition of On Your Money tomorrow at this time. Financial planner Kevin McKinley will have information and advice on your personal finances. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.